Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com. Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
You can laugh. I was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'm going to leave it there.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
Come on down to Anfield and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawny man?
So I was listening to popular sports podcast Second Captains on my flight home from my holidays last Friday, and I heard old Helen Lovejoy here, Ken Early, giving out about young Nathan Collins and the damage he might do to himself if he doesn't clean up his knee slide technique after his increasingly frequent goal-scoring interventions. Then I tuned into Manchester United Arsenal on Saturday morning, and there was Nuno Tavares almost decapitating himself after 3 minutes, attempting a knee slide goal celebration that was actually the world's most farcical attempt at ploughing a field with your own knee. As I was watching, I was convinced that he had actually smashed his own patella in the act of celebrating his own goal. So I thought to myself, maybe Ken's pearl clutching is in order here. Will someone please think of the goal scorer? So thank you, Ken, and welcome to today's Second Captain's Football podcast.
Hello, Kieran, how are you? Welcome back.
I'm delighted to be back on a weekend where Arsenal took control of the race for fourth. Liverpool were made to huff and puff a bit for their 3 points yesterday. Everton are starting to look a little haunted, and the resurgence of the aforementioned Burnley continues apace. So plenty of you to get stuck into, Ken. I can feel you just straining at my presenter's leash on loan to me from McDevitt for the day. But settle, please, just for a moment, while I remind our Monday listeners that to sign up for 4 more shows this week, including Champions League semi-final coverage across all the shows, as well as access to all of our extensive back catalogue, including Players' Chair episodes with Richie Sadler and Politics Podcast with the aforementioned Ken Early, then it's just €5 a month plus VAT wherever you are in the world. Just go to secondcaptains.com/join and we'd be delighted to have you along. We're going to hear from Miguel Delaney and Rory Smith of the New York Times a little later on. But Ken, if you could report on some sport, please, that would be swell. Where to begin is kind of an interesting question this weekend. But I think perhaps maybe the Merseyside Derby, Ken, maybe the thing that's burning a hole in your consciousness, and the, as I've already mentioned, Everton's problems look ever more intractable. What did you make of just how they set up for their derby game against Liverpool yesterday?
Well, it was a game which everybody, when they were watching the game, seemed to quickly form the same impression, which is that this is like that game when Frank Lampard was in the Chelsea team that played at Anfield in April 2014 and defended and counterattacked, and Steven Gerrard fell over and Chelsea won 2-0 and blew up Liverpool's title challenge, and Jose Mourinho ran in his sportswear towards the Chelsea supporters and leapt in the air and punched the air. And Frank Lampard, who was the number 10, the 35-year-old number 10, as he mentioned after the game, he walked off that field a happy man. Well, I mean, you know, happy at a job well done. Not happy about the fact that Chelsea weren't going to win the title that season. They'd already blown it. I think Chelsea that season... That's the thing about that Chelsea game, is that Mourinho actually kind of picked the team as a sort of a protest. They were between Champions League semi-finals, if I recall correctly. And I don't think he really expected to get anything out of it, but he didn't really need to either. What he was focused on doing was winning the Champions League, which they ultimately didn't because they got beaten by Atletico Madrid. But he kind of picked this as a sort of a, you know, what can I do with the authorities in England prejudiced against Chelsea, you know, similar to the way that Jurgen Klopp is complaining about having to play Newcastle next Saturday in the early kickoff. And he sort of wasn't actually expecting to get anything out of the game, but then it happened, you know, it just all came together. And what was a kind of a throwaway game from Rio has gone down as like one of his defining masterclasses. The great moments of Jose's career are always him celebrating in an enemy stadium, but next to the fallen carcass of what everyone thought was the favourites, Manchester United, when it was, you know, Porto 2004, Mourinho running down the touchline at Old Trafford after Porto's iconic game.
Yeah, Inter, Barcelona, Inter, yeah.
turning the sprinklers on to try and get Mourinho off the pitch at Inter as he, and then Anfield 2014 with Chelsea. These are, you know, his classic moments, but you know. So it's kind of gone into history as a big milestone in football tactical history, I think, which is unfortunate because it was a kind of a freakish outcome and certainly not a game that I think anyone should take any learnings from. And it certainly would have been an unwise way for Frank Lampard, I believe, to approach this game yesterday. And Frank Lampard actually specifically denied that game was his blueprint for the one yesterday, you know, and he because he was asked about this afterwards. I mean, everyone was sort of commenting on it. Carragher kept talking about it during the game. You know, Gary Neville, who wasn't on the game, was tweeting about it. Oh, this is like Chelsea 2014. You know, although they're not as good as Jose, Chelsea and Liverpool are better than they were then. And then Jeff Shreves asked Lampard about it after the game, and Lampard I thought it was quite funny watching him. As he remembered the game, he started to smile. He briefly looked happy, like his haggard face. His haggard face just became momentarily warm and happy.
That terrible tea bags ad. It's either Barry's or Lyons. I can't remember. I wasn't beautiful, but I was beautiful that day, says grandmother to granddaughter.
God, that sounds really terrible. I don't think I've seen that.
Come on, that's part of the national consciousness at this age, Ken Bill.
Oh, I can't.
I'll send it on to you later. But
Jesus, that sounds really grim. Frank Lampard would never say something like that. I mean, he was beautiful. The number 10, 35, you know, did a really solid, did a really professional job. We did a great thing. Yeah. But no, that wasn't what. And then he remembered that he's actually the Everton manager and they're going to get relegated. And he stopped smiling and he realized that he's living in a much colder, crueler, bleaker reality now than that day back 8 years ago. But what Lampard then said was, he said, we're not in a position to go toe-to-toe with a team like this. When you look at what they're doing to teams, you know, what we're in a position to do is be smart. Be smart. Be very disciplined. We ask the players to be disciplined, be smart. And then, and we did that really well for an hour. And then, unfortunately, the goal goes in and it becomes very difficult after that. So that's the way he sees it. And I just thought, well, there you go. I mean, he says that it's not based on 2014. But it clearly is, like, and not necessarily in the sense that, you know, I've been in a situation a lot like this before. What we do is, you know, we kind of copy. What did Jose say that day? We sort of copy the game plan and we go out there, we frustrate, we waste time, and, you know, that'll get them to, they'll start clucking. And, you know, the abiding memory of that game was the way Liverpool were hurrying, you know, Gerrard running to grab the ball out of Mourinho's hands, Mourinho on the sideline. That was after just a couple of minutes, I think. You know, Suarez screaming at Mark Schwarzer, who was the Chelsea goalkeeper that day, to you know, hurry up, take the goal kick. Well, this is a joke. You know, you're like, he's not going to do it just because you're shouting at him to do it. You know, stop wasting energy shouting at Chelsea's goalkeeper, not the time waste. I mean, moan to the ref, maybe, but like, this is a joke. And that was at 0-0. This is from a team that only needed a draw. So that was, what you could say is that was a team that was super hyped up and nothing like this, the current Liverpool team, who have been winning things, winning matches, winning trophies for several seasons now. You know, that team, that Rodgers team had played about 20 good matches. You know, it was like a team that had sort of unexpectedly come together. Suarez was having, you know, the season of his life. Gerrard was kind of squeezing out one last great season. You know, Coutinho turned out to be a good player. Sterling and Sturridge were playing well. You know, there was a lot of good players who were kind of fitting. You know, Henderson had sort of started to click for them. The defense was a complete clown show. But the team had won it. But they didn't really have any deep grounding. They didn't have any kind of, resilient sort of... they hadn't been tested, really battle tested.
Or a back catalogue that they could, you know, look back on and say, in these situations, we have dug it out in the past, therefore we are supremely confident that if we stay patient here, things will happen for us, we will be okay.
We know exactly what we have to do. We've faced this problem, like we faced this exact problem, you know, 100 times, and we've won 90 of those matches, and the way that you win a match like this is by doing... You know, what you eventually saw Liverpool do, I think, in the game, I mean, that great piece of play by Salah, you know, just put in these dangerous crosses. Or the second goal was maybe a better illustration of their typical method. You know, where Henderson just playing that cross. How many times do you see Henderson play that sort of diagonal ball into that exact space? And then it's a kind of an inspirational, a moment of brilliance by Diaz to sort of turn it into a simple chance for Origi. But like... you've seen this mechanism so many times. It's literally a mechanism. It's like, get the ball to there, then stick it across the way and try and get it back across the goal, and that's going to be a chance. whereas the Liverpool team that went one down to Chelsea, it was, especially the way they did it, it was Steven Gerrard thinking, I've got to save this team. I've done this, and it's my responsibility to score the equalizing goal that will save the day here. And he ends up having nine shots from the back of central midfield. I mean, that is just, you know. So what I'm saying is that Lampard said he did not base it on that game, but being part of a game like that has completely conditioned the way that Lampard thinks about football. And so he thinks, I mean, he revealed that he thinks it's smart to go to Anfield and play against the Jurgen Klopp Liverpool with a game plan that's like, we're going to sit in, defend our box, and basically hope to nick one. And he thinks that's smart. This is not smart. This is basically declaring defeat. This is a way of saying, we're not going to get anything out of this match, and we're going to just make sure that we don't run around a lot. I mean, in that sense, maybe there is a rationality to it. You know, in the sense that, well, I'm going to find a way to lose the game that involves us expending the least amount of energy as a team by simply, you know, sort of standing in front of our box, kicking the ball away. So you had Everton having, a really low...
But if you had talked to Liverpool fans after 70 minutes of that game, even after the first goal, you know, they were still by no means in a relaxed frame of mind.
No, because they mostly remember 2014 as well. I mean, when you saw did you see the Alisson moment at the end? When Alisson...
Yes.
I mean, which was good. I mean, it was... a bit of goalkeeper banter. It's coming more into the game. I mean, Aaron Ramsdale was at it again, you know? Maybe a slightly malicious edge to Aaron Ramsdale's banter as poor Bruno Fernandes missed that penalty. And Aaron Ramsdale got right up in his business. Aaron Ramsdale, we'll get to Ramsdale. But it was a bit of banter from, first of all, Pickford, and then returned sarcastically by Alisson, which was pretty funny. But the thing that sticks in my mind about it is when they showed the joyous crowd shot of everybody laughing. I was like, look how old the crowd is. There's a lot of old bangers in the crowd these days in Premier League games. You know what I mean? What I'm saying is that those...
Old bangers.
I mean, I'd be there myself, you know. I mean,
I'd
be in the same category myself. You know, am I above the median age now? Yeah, I guess I am. I guess I've made it into the top half of the age distribution. So
everything after this is a bonus.
Yeah, just on my way up that population pyramid. You know, just eyeing the steadily narrowing pyramid of it.
Can't wait to graduate out of that one.
Anyway, but look, so all of this history is there, you know, soaked into the crowd, into the memories. But really, this is just a recipe for defeat. And I feel like the responsibility is on a coach like Lampard, who, remember, is a young coach. The only coaches younger than him in the Premier League are Arteta and Steven Gerrard. You know, he's younger than all the others. And yet this is just a seriously antiquated way of trying to get a result. And really, I think you need to come up with something better than that. You know, you need to have some better ideas. I mean, Brighton had a better idea than that. Now, you could say, well, you know, Brighton played Liverpool at a better moment of the season. You know, they kind of got them on a good day and so on and so forth. And there is an element of truth to that, I guess. You know, their form at that point wasn't as good. But, you know,
Does goal difference not come into this as well, though? You know what I mean? That, like, if you can go out and... What you're talking about basically is Everton should have gone and played and pressed Liverpool high up the field and tried to win the ball back high up the field.
They need to do something else. That, you know, something. What I'm saying is that what they did was as close as you can get to just declaring defeat before the game as it's possible to get, right? And they needed to try something else because it's not unheard of. The thing about Liverpool is it's not a case of, it's very difficult to defend, to keep a clean sheet against them for 90 minutes. You have to score. And realistically, if you want to not lose, you have to score twice. And if you can do that, and 12 teams have done it this season, scored at least two, a couple of them have scored three. If you can do that, then you probably won't lose. That's what you got to do. That's what you got to aim to do. I mean, Everton did it last season. You know, again, that was an example at Anfield. I mean, that was an example, I suppose, of them catching Liverpool in a weaker moment. But if I look at this season, the obvious example is Brighton, and I feel as though, you know, that was a 2-2 draw as well at Anfield, and I feel as though this is kind of the, you know, Tottenham also had a 2-2 draw. Tottenham have better players than Everton for sure. What I'm saying is I'm not sure that Frank Lampard necessarily has that in his locker. I'm not sure he has a game plan like that.
They're in a really, really bad spot now. When you look at, they're 2 points behind, they've played a game less than Burnley, but how much of an advantage is that when you just keep losing games, as Everton have been doing over the last 15 games or so. Their goal difference is 5 goals worse off than Burnley. You look at Burnley's next 2 games are against Watford and Villa. I mean, that's not good. That is not a good scenario for Everton to be in.
No, it's now looking like oh no, this is it. And
Everton have Chelsea and Leicester coming up in their next 2 games.
Yeah.
And if Burnley were to take another 4 points from their next, from those 2 imminently winnable games against teams 2 places above them and 2 places below them, then you're looking at them being on 37 points.
Ooh. Yeah, it's not good. It's not good. But what, it wasn't the
What
only
about
thing.
Ramsdale then? Do we want to move on to Ramsdale, do we?
Well,
and company, as I like to call Arsenal, of course, these days.
What we had yesterday was two skipping penalty takers, miserably missing penalties. Which I thought was sort of interesting, because I remember when Bruno Fernandes and Jorginho were doing this, you know, in their pomp of a season or two ago, it looked as though it was like, oh, these guys have kind of solved penalty taking. Like
they've cracked the code. I mean, it's literally impossible. How can you stop this?
how can this be stopped? And so to see these,
how can this be stopped is not a thing that you said when you looked at watch Fabianski like nearly fall over himself, like fall past the ball. The ball rolled so slowly into his hands.
Yeah,
I mean, it was just like, yeah.
Well,
it just looks so bad. It looks so bad when it goes wrong.
I thought this is a Pat Nevin level penalty, and Pat Nevin himself, I saw, had tweeted about his own very famous penalty where he took on one memorable occasion one of the most feeble penalty anyone had seen up till that point on television. and so I described it as the second worst I've seen at Stamford Bridge, he said, still unwilling to renounce the title of the worst ever penalty. But I saw Geir Jorda, this guy who posts about football tactics and so on Twitter, coming in with a theory that actually the goalkeepers have started to respond to the skip. They've started trying to figure out what's going on. And basically, because the technique is goalkeeper dependent, it's like what you're doing is waiting to see what the goalkeeper does and then you know, putting it the other way, that a little bit of fakery by the goalkeeper, and he does it with reference to the Fabianski. This was the you know, West Ham against Chelsea, that essentially Fabianski had fooled Jorginho into thinking he's going one way when he's always actually going to go the other way, and he saves it. However, I'm not sure about this. I kind of feel as though Jorginho just hit the penalty so badly that it was quite difficult. I don't want to say not difficult for him not to save, but I just feel as though if Jorginho kind of crisply knocks that one into the corner, he's going to score anyway. And the same thing with Bruno Fernandes, who, if you look at Ramsdale didn't do any of this Fabianski stuff. He just completely went the wrong way. he totally went the wrong way. There was never a moment when he looked like, and Bruno went and, you know, aimed for the empty side of the goal, and then he hit the outside of the post. So again, it was a terribly aimed penalty, and just a badly struck penalty, I thought. What does Ramsdale do? Literally, like, just look at it again. It's unbelievable. Straight up, jumps off the ground, runs towards Bruno, and then celebrates, you know, just in front of him, but like in a huge way. Like, Ramsdale just looks so big when he does this. You know what I mean? It's like how his arms and legs are sort of so wide apart. You know what I mean? It's like this. It's like there's like a 10-foot wingspan. He somehow manages to create the impression of.
It's like David Byrd of Talking Heads would look like if he was a goalkeeper.
It was just,
you know, the massive suited David Byrd.
It was like, what are you? You know, and you didn't do anything. You actually that wasn't you. You didn't build that.
You almost ended up in the stand. You avoided the ball so studiously there.
But you know, it was a huge moment, obviously, because this would have been 2-2 for could have been 2-2 for Manchester United, which would have been a big momentum shift in that game with the way that it had gone. A messy game. Ultimately, Granit Xhaka comes out on top. You know, I mean, we were talking about Xhaka myself. No, I'm talking about Xhaka last week. He's having a good good games at the moment. Arsenal, maybe he's lucky to get away with the goal being allowed. I mean, I think justification from because it was an offside, or Nketiah's in an offside position in front of De Gea, but they said, yeah, well, Lindelof is there as well, so he's in the same line. So, you can't see through Lindelof either. So that was their justification. But, it's looking pretty bad.
It was a hell of a strike, you'd have to say, Ken.
It was. And of course, who was there? Who was there in the build-up? But Bruno Fernandes, you know. And it is there is a kind of a sudden change in the mood around Bruno, isn't there? It's amazing. It's like all since he signed that new contract. Well, it's not all since he signed the new contract, but they did give him a mega deal, you know, apparently doubling his salary like 3 weeks ago until 2026. And since when, they have announced... obviously, Eric Ten Hag. And everyone, have you seen the Eric Ten Hag video?
The Eric Ten Hag video. What video is this now?
There's so much excitement over shouty Eric Ten Hag in the video. I have seen, there's a Eric Ten Hag footage shows he's about to give Manchester United something they desperately need. Is the headline on Samuel Lookhurst's piece in the Manchester Evening News. Bruno Fernandes is more effective at moaning at teammates than taking penalties from Man United this season, and the refusal of anyone to give any back is another issue. The blurb continues of the article. And so what this is a video from, I believe, December 2019, when Erik ten Hag is managing Ajax. He's still the Ajax manager for now. And he is shouting at a 20-year-old Ajax player, Noah Lang, who is only recently broken into the team. He's shouting at sideline, basically, you have to run deep, you have to drop, you have to track back, basically. And then your man, that it seemed like the player who we can't see because we're just looking at Ten Hag in this video, the player is like, meh, meh, you know, says something like, and Ten Hag just goes, no, you know, you've got to shut up, shut your mouth, you just have to do it. You just need to do it. Cut it out. It's our game, not just yours. So that's the, you know, and so he's really laid down the law with this guy.
With this Dutch teenager, which I fear...
20-year-old, to be fair. 20 years old. Two decades.
I apologize. I misspoke. Yeah. I apologize. Let me rephrase. So that's fine with this Dutch youngster.
Yeah.
And I believe a 20-year-old is still a youngster.
Yeah.
Basically, the whole idea of this is that will he be doing that? Will he have the stones, Ken, quite frankly, to do this to the seasoned pros at Old Trafford?
Well, I mean,
that is the big question.
He might. I'm sure he will. But I do wonder if, I mean, will they react as positively as Noah Lang? Although, did Noah Lang react positively? I mean, apparently he was shipped out on loan pretty soon after that. And Ten Hag brought in Ryan Babel. So maybe that's good. Maybe that's what Manchester United need. It all promises to get a bit more shouty at Manchester United.
And then I went in to get the ass that fell over the bit of tubing anyway.
I went in to get a little bit of tubing.
And I looks around and there's Jerry Duff. Duffer's dad.
I went in to get a little bit of tubing.
So it was a very interesting day. Everyone should go to the motor factors on a Friday afternoon when it's sunny.
Rory Smith, Miguel Delaney, good morning to you both. Rory, can I start with you? My God, it's really happening. Everton are going down.
Yeah, do you know, I didn't think until I looked at the table on Sunday that there was any chance at all of Everton being relegated, because you kind of think, well, Burnley surely can't get enough points. Watford and Norwich are gone already. Burnley looked like they were kind of stumbling towards relegation. At some point, Burnley will get relegated just as the size of the club. And then you realise that Everton are 2 points adrift now, with, I think, 5 games left to go. Maybe they might have 6 to play. And next weekend, Burnley are at Watford, who can't win at home. And they play before Everton play at home to Chelsea. At which point, Everton could well be 5 points from safety if they lose to Chelsea with 5 games left. That's really bad. I think there is now a very real possibility that Everton get relegated. It still seems somehow unlikely that it will happen, but they are in deep water, if that's... They're in the shit, basically. And
yeah,
it's hard to see them getting out of it. They do have 2 or 3 games between Chelsea and Arsenal that are winnable. But the problem is, if Burnley keep picking up points and Burnley do look transformed, then it's not really up to Everton to decide. And that's a really, really bad position to be in.
Yeah, Burnley transformed is something they could really have done without. And Sean Dyche leaving has not, well, so far hasn't had a bad, you know, they're getting a bit of a bounce out of that, it looks like. So they've picked up a little bit of speed. While Everton, I mean, Miguel, at Anfield yesterday, Frank Lampard described what they had done as smart, or he said, we're not in a position to go top to toe, we're in a position to be smart. They had, according to some sources, the worst or the lowest ever share of possession by a Premier League team in a match. The other source claimed that it was only the second worst ever since data had been recorded. You know, they had a central midfielder who had 2 passes, you know, a central defender who had 3 passes. You know, Shane Duffy had 44 completed passes when he played at Anfield earlier this season. So what I'm saying is, this was a total tactical debacle from Everton, and Lampard's description of it as of their approach as smart shows that he, he thinks about football in a very antiquated way.
It would be unlike Frank Lampard to give himself credit in any situation, of course.
He was trying to give the team credit collectively, but yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, ultimately Frank got it right, so no blame can be put on his feet. That said, I have to say I thought it was the right approach going into the game, and basically until Andy Robertson scored. Because let's be fair, when you're in the situation Everton are in, and when you're so inferior to what Liverpool are probably in, kind of, you know, one of these spells of form that Klopp has had over his 5.5 years, where it's just that sweet spot where they hit a different plane. So if you try to take them on in any sort of open football match, you'll just get destroyed. So, I mean, Chelsea 2014 was the obvious example that was used a lot. Also a bit of Atletico Madrid, in that being the inferior side, they just set about trying to do anything to disrupt Liverpool. And for a lot of the game, it did work. It might have gone differently had they got the penalty. And also, I felt it was actually quite rare in this title running so far. I know it's only been brief so far, But even if you look at, say, City's game against Brighton, or certainly against Watford on Saturday, because I think there's that feel for all of these running games where we go into them and there's that kind of slight edge about whether one of the two will drop up, but actually they'll just be tinnel up by half time and that'll be that. Whereas this actually felt like kind of a classic run-in game, and that there was proper pressure. You could actually feel in the first half, certainly, edge quite early on in the half, edge transmitting from Everton, who were obviously in a much worse situation, to Liverpool, who had a bit of anxiety creeping into the game. Fabinho had that wild shot about even, what was it, 10 minutes before the Robertson goal. So there was that sense of kind of nerves building. But then, of course, the thing about those sort of tactics that Lampard put up is that once you concede, you've got nowhere to go, which is why it is entirely results-based football. But
if it's results-based, why doesn't he look at the results of teams that try to play this way against Liverpool? They lose. It's like 100% loss rate.
Yeah, if you try to play out against Liverpool, you'd get beaten worse.
But you've got more of a chance against them. I mean, the evidence shows that you have more of a chance. I mean, if you just let them have the ball and you let them attack you, they are going to beat you and probably going to beat you by several goals. I mean, if you look at it, everyone from six, whenever Liverpool have 68% of possession or more in a game, and it happens quite a lot, they always win. There's one team that has managed to not lose to Liverpool in that situation, which was the 10-man Arsenal team that drew 0-0 in the Carabao Cup, the game that Granit Xhaka got sent off in. And they managed to keep a clean sheet. But in that game, Liverpool didn't have to win the game on the night. This is a strategy which is a 100% guaranteed defeat, as close as you can get to that in football.
So I would say that Everton, the easy parallel to make as you were watching it was with Atletico Madrid and what they did to Man City. And that, I think the same principle applies, that in the first leg of that Champions League quarterfinal, Atletico were credited with kind of limiting City to just one goal and with shutting them down. But it was not in any way a kind of admirable defensive performance, because they carried no threat whatsoever. So you could see, I was at that game, and you could see after about an hour, City thought, hang on, these are not going to come forward. We can commit as many men as we like to attack. We can keep the ball, and we will eventually generate chances. And Foden comes on, plays that pass, De Bruyne scores, and that's the goal that takes City through. That's not how you are meant to play that way. The way to play that way, as you've said, Ken, is you can spoil all you like, you can time waste, you can feign injury as Richarlison did, you can try and use every trick in the book. And I don't think anyone should have any moral qualms with that, because we're not all Victorian chambermaids. Like, it's professional sport, get on with it. But you have to carry a threat. And Everton, although they did have one or two attacks, they were largely one player running forward on their own and seeing how far they could get. And there was the chance that Robertson cleared off the line after 1-0, and there was the penalty claim, although I'm surprised that's been quite as controversial as it has been.
Which the Matip penalty?
Did you think it was a penalty?
Oh, definitely.
That's absolutely fine. I respect your opinion. I saw it and couldn't see what the fuss was about.
Pushed them in the back.
On the replay, I actually agree with Rory, I must say. I thought in real time, I thought it was a foul. Then from the other angle, you could see that actually, I thought that Matip didn't actually push him. It just his kind of... There was no force in the arm.
He got in front of him, though. I thought, it's the way that it is.
He runs across.
So this is going out. All right, there's a new embargo on this, but just in, Everton are going to complain to PGMOL about the penalty that wasn't.
Right, okay. And this isn't the first time they've been screwed. I mean, I know that you think this one is debatable. I mean, I'd say it's certainly more debatable decision than, say, the Rodri one that they complained about before. And, I think they got an apology.
The Rodri one, I'll be massively accused of bias here. The Rodri one was a penalty, without a shadow of a doubt. That was definitely a penalty. This one, I think, the issue is that Jordan comes across him, and it is whether it's Matip's natural motion. But I didn't see it live. I only saw it on replay because I was having my dinner. Yeah. And the... I looked at it expecting to see some sort of absolutely remarkable refereeing fiasco, like the one in Lazio Milan, where the Lazio keeper handballed the ball outside the area and wasn't sent off somehow. But yeah. I was really surprised that it looked like there will be penalties like that are given, but I don't think any of them are penalties. It didn't strike me as that controversial. But the bigger problem for Everton was that as the game wore on, Liverpool could tell there is no real consistent threat here. They might, you know, Richarlison might run from the halfway line and score. That's always a possibility. You can't mitigate for wonder goals, or, you know, Anthony Gordon is lively and poses a bit of a threat. But Liverpool clearly decided, well, look, we don't need three players in midfield. We can shove Origi on up front because they aren't interested in coming forward. And to me, and this was true of Everton and it was true of Atletico Madrid, for it to be a truly kind of defining rearguard action, you need to pose a threat, because that's the only way you sow a seed of doubt into the opposition's mind about committing men forward. Because ultimately, as you say, Ken, if you give the opposition the ball and you let them commit as many players forward as they want, they will score.
Yeah, just on the penalty issue there. I mean, Frank Lampard he's been quite outspoken about this in a sort of a strange way. Like, you know, after the, what I mean is, he sounds conspiracy minded. You know, he's, you know, there's some strange things going on with VAR. And he has, okay, been screwed a couple of times.
He made a reference before the game, didn't he, to how you don't get those at Anfield.
Well, this is the thing. He said this after the game, but in fact, Everton have got two penalties in the previous four matches they've played there, both of which I would say were more debatable than the one they didn't get, the one they didn't get from Matip. But I mean, what do you make of that? Is this just Frank Lampard being a sore loser? I mean, is there a problem here? I mean, there have been some mad decisions.
His usual ref shot bollocks, though, isn't it? It's like, it's
this is the thing that you just say it's ref chat bollocks, as though there's never been a refereeing scandal.
Well, I mean, but in modern Premier League, it's just, I mean, basic errors that happen. Again, the argument is that VAR is supposed to have eliminated this. All it's done,
but it has, really, but it has in fact made it worse. Like, honestly,
It's made it worse because people think that a VAR is about 100% accuracy, which it can't be. And that just, but because you have the recourse of VAR, it makes any errors feel all the worse, because, oh, this is what it's supposed to get rid of. But there will still be errors.
And it's, well, just, I mean, they're looking at a film there. They're literally looking at a video from several angles of Rodri handling the ball. You know what I mean? How can this be missed?
It still comes down to subjective interpretation. I mean, look, we've got, none of us are as versed in the rules as any officials, and when we're debating it, it's just sort of basically noise by the aggrieved, as it always will be.
There is a desperation, and as I say, I have some sympathy with Everton on the Rodri one, the one in the Merseyside derby this year. Yeah, Ken, I admire and respect you enough to say to genuinely think that if you think it's a penalty, then to at least question my belief that it wasn't. That isn't true of Miguel. The one in the Merseyside derby last year was ridiculous, and I think there was another one that Lovren gave away, which should have been awarded because it was Dejan Lovren, but wasn't a penalty either. So it's, you know, this idea that teams don't get penalties at Anfield is demonstrably untrue, and also I don't think Liverpool get that many penalties, to be perfectly honest.
But they certainly don't give many away. I think that some people are pointing out it's 46 matches since they're certainly due a big penalty against them.
I'm not quite sure that's how it works.
They're cruising for a penalty bruising.
But if you go for long enough without giving away a penalty, you should have to give away
eventually,
a penalty.
Yeah. You know, there's a reason why this is the longest current run. You know, they've been doing well to not give one away. They've got Newcastle up next.
There is a point at which it does feel like Everton have a particular bee in their bonnet about Liverpool, and yeah, I know what you mean about it. Lampard comes across as being slightly more conspiratorially minded than most other managers.
Which is interesting, because he's spent a lot of time at the very top of the game and knows what kind of an environment it is.
I would query whether Frank Lampard has maybe benefited from one or two slightly questionable penalty claims in his career himself, to be perfectly honest. There's no question that big teams, the elite teams, give away fewer penalties. Partly because they're not defending as much, but partly because referees are conscious, I think, subconsciously aware of the fact that awarding a penalty against those teams is a more controversial thing than not, that they maybe need to be more sure that it's a penalty to give the penalty, and that I suspect applies to the VARs as well. That is a thing, but the fact that Everton continually complain about it, I would say, is not a great look, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah. Can I ask you then about the team that actually both Liverpool and Manchester City have to play against, and a team that has been doing well better than Manchester City in this year? I think is it this calendar year that Newcastle United are the second place team? And you know, when you look at what they've done, their last 14 matches, they've won 10 of those matches, and it's been a phenomenal turnaround. And I just wanted to question you about what you think is going on here. How you would explain Newcastle's sudden emergence as the Northern powerhouse. I've been reading some of the local press. I see Mark Douglas reports that Newcastle have a no dickheads policy for players that they bring in. Luke Edwards in the Daily Telegraph has spoken about team photos. Now this became a little bit controversial. Well, Newcastle did a dressing room photo after a win, which included Yasser Al-Rumaya, and you know, so they had some of the sort of ownership figures that were in there as well in this. And Luke Edwards has written an article a couple of days back explaining how this is Eddie Howe's psychological management of the squad. The squad photo is a sort of a carrot, if you will, that the players, you know, they aim, you know, they share in this moment after the game, and then it's a way of celebrating their success and bonding them closer together. And this has something to do with their improved form. I mean, what do you think of that? What do you think about that?
First of all, I mean, I don't mean this as a comment on Luke. He did some really good work on the takeover. But my perception on these sort of photos is they're exactly the sort of really minute detail that, when something goes well, they're held up, because they're so visible, they're held up well. This is obviously such a huge influence. And when things are going bad, it's the flip side. When really, they're just small, mostly irrelevant details. Because the most relevant detail of Newcastle's season is the fact that they're the first club in the history of English football to get anywhere close to 100 million investment in January. There's no getting away from that. And I know people will accuse us of kind of, particularly like given my coverage of the takeover, of bitterness, of whatever, but it's a fact.
I have to say, I agree with you that Newcastle being by far the biggest spending club in the world in January, it has more explanatory power when looking at their massive improvement in form since then than the team photo thing that Eddie Howe has brought in.
Counterintuitive argument. How on earth could hiring five new players be more important than taking a picture?
But there's this urge as well to paint kind of Howe as some, you know, as like this tactical mastermind. And he's obviously a good coach, Eddie Howe. I don't think anyone will get away from that. But again,
well, he spends all his time thinking about football.
Yeah, it's easier to coach when you've got
he
better
doesn't
players.
Think about anything else. Yeah, he thinks he's a complete monomaniac.
I have to say, though, this whole little theme, it's also, and I suppose maybe some of the reaction to Luke's tweet reflected this a little bit, but it does provoke the difficulty. And people might fairly talk about the hypocrisy of this, given the way Chelsea and Manchester City and others have escaped it to a certain degree. But the difficulty of basically talking about Newcastle as any kind of normal football team. Because I think by the time that takeover happened, we were all so attuned to these issues. I must say, given the intention of the takeover, I find it very difficult, and even more difficult, say, than Manchester City, which I probably shouldn't, to talk about them in any sort of normal way, like a normal football team. Because it does feel that once you're talking about them in any sort of normal plan, you're basically legitimising or normalising what it is, which is basically... I mean, Rory, there was a great line in that piece Rory did at the weekend over Bayern Munich. I can't remember who exactly said it, Rory.
Dario Minden from Unsere Kurve, which is a fan organisation in Germany.
Yeah, yeah. Basically that, you know, in all this debate about 50+1 and how uncompetitive German football is, well, I mean, when you really break it down, and I think he was absolutely right in this point, his one club winning all the time, is it really worse than the moral problem of an autocratic dictator using a football club for political purposes? I mean, when you stand back and consider the perspective, it's there's no comparison. And what
they have a no dickheads policy.
Well, I mean,
the thing about
No, they don't apply. It's only a downward. It's a downward facing no dickheads policy. Upward facing, it's more realistic.
That the no dickheads thing. This is, and Miguel's dealing with much more serious issues. But the no dickheads thing is that comes out of rugby. That's the All Black policy.
Yeah.
That famously, you're meant to clean up the dressing room and generally behave like a normal human being. Literally every club now says they have a no dickheads policy, which is remarkable given that there are loads of dickheads in football. But I don't think that is the same as the photos. Like, it's, yeah, fine. They'll have this kind of, we want to sign nice people. Obviously they do. But like you say, the thing that has changed is partly that Steve Bruce wasn't doing a good job at Newcastle. The fans hated him. I think a lot of the players they were maybe fond of him as a person. I think Steve Bruce is quite a nice bloke. But I don't think they kind of believe that he knew what he was doing or could get them out of trouble. Howe's come in, he's young, he's energetic, he's dynamic, he's given them a bit of belief, results have followed, and that has bred success. And I think you can say, I think it's legitimate to say that Eddie Howe has done a good job. It's also legitimate to say that at least part of that is because they went and spent nearly 100 million quid in January and made the squad a lot better. I think if Eddie Howe had the same squad as Steve Bruce, then they wouldn't be ninth. I think that's blindingly obvious. But Miguel's right. The tricky bit for all of us is, at what point do you introduce the fact that, okay, this is not being done for the... And Newcastle fans will get cross about it, because Man City fans get cross about it, Chelsea fans get cross about it, that this is not being done solely for the greater glorification of Newcastle United and the return of you know, English football's great sleeping giant. That's not what it's about. It's about Saudi Arabia kind of presenting a face to the world and embedding itself in British society, Western society, in the same way as happened at Man City, and to an extent in a different context at Chelsea. But those three things are all true, and that's fine. That's fine. That's just how it is. There is no getting away from any of those three facts. That the fact that it is a sports washing project doesn't mean Eddie Howe hasn't done a good job at a sports washing project. He has, but you can't separate the money or the purpose of it from that. And the one thing on that side of it, does I get this kind of, not as much as Miguel, but you hear this kind of, that the southern media are envious of Newcastle. That I guarantee that if Newcastle had been bought out by some cold-blooded, heartless
American hedge fund,
none of this would be happening. None of it. And that you know, you can have your problems with hedge funds buying football teams, and we probably all should have a problem with hedge funds buying football teams, to be perfectly honest. But ultimately, the reaction would be far more akin to the one that Newcastle fans sincerely believe they feel they should be given, which is, you know, this is a nice story and it's good that Newcastle are going to be good again. If it was some weirdly named sort of Black Hawk down capital who bought them, then there would be none of this. There would be none of this, because their interests are in improving a club so they can sell it on or whatever, which aren't pure, and they're not, you know, they're not kind of Delia Smith or Fernando Rog who runs Villarreal, and they're doing it all because they love the place. But it's not what Saudi Arabia are doing. That's where there is a line, and some things are one side of it and some things are the other side of it, and Saudi Arabia is on the other side of it.
What I am surprised by one thing about Newcastle, which is sort of how quickly this improvement has happened. You know, like, I mean, if you look at it, I think their previous 14 matches, you know, they'd won one, and like, yeah, before the 14 of which they've won 10 since their sort of big spend. So things have come together very fast. There's a lot of circumstances there, you know, there's a sort of surge of optimism going on. Maybe they can't sort of sustain this for a long time before running into problems. But at the moment, it looks as though this is a team that could realistically aim to qualify for the Champions League next season. I mean, you know, if you're getting better results than Manchester City over almost half a season, then, you know, you've got to start thinking of yourself as a contender. I'm sure they're going to improve even more. And with that kind of, there's a tangible sense among the players that, you know, this we're now at a club that's going places. This is an exciting place to be, you know, as a football player who wants to win things and make money. And so I don't actually want us to talk any more about Newcastle, but the fact that this sort of new player is involved and is competing for this limited scope of prizes. Does this put Erik ten Hag under even more pressure?
A screeching segue from Ken.
Well, it was Thursday when we had actually recorded most of our football pod on Thursday when they confirmed the news. So we haven't really got a chance to sort of get into it. Can I just ask you both if you think they've chosen the right guy? I mean, there is some talk that some of the people involved there that it wasn't like a unanimous decision necessarily. Manchester, I'm not saying you need these things to be unanimous, but that there was some people who still thought that Maurizio Pochettino would have been the best bet for them.
I think Midge has covered the story more closely than me, but Ten Hag makes sense. He's a coach on the rise. He's kind of cutting edge in the sense that you're not dealing with someone like Van Gaal or even Mourinho, who was probably on their decline and the game was moving away from them, or even David Moyes, who at the time he took the United job probably didn't have the skill set to manage a club of at that stage was probably the second best team in the world ish. That was too much of a leap. So it makes sense in that sense. I think he taps them into a market of players. He develops players. He will coach the players properly. There's an argument that a lot of these players at Man United haven't been properly kind of coached in a sort of very modern way for some time, if ever, because of the managers that they've had. I met him a few years ago when Ajax made the semis of the Champions League. He's energetic. He's dynamic. He's really bright. I think he will be. I think he's quite likable. That all matters. The most telling point on this actually came from Alvaro Romeo, who's a Spanish journalist, who's pointed out the kind of parallel with Cantona in 92, that Cantona came in and suddenly made everything click. That United team was a good team. They'd come close to winning the league the year before. But Cantona's arrival just gelled everything together almost instantly. They had this superstar. They had this player who was a cut above everybody else in the country. They had this inspirational figure. And it just gave them... It made everything work. And I think we often think about football like that, as a kind of jigsaw to be completed. And if you slot a player or a manager in, then suddenly the picture becomes clear. I think that's underselling how modern elite football works now, that it's not about individuals, it's about systems, it's not about kind of personal inspiration, it's about kind of collective hierarchies. Clubs are complex organisms, and you're competing with, in England particularly, with two teams who are kind of best in class at what they do in Man City and Liverpool. And the idea that Ten Hag, however good a coach he is, might be able to come in and immediately make everything work, even in kind of 2 years, is probably a little bit ambitious. It's a good start, but there's so much at United that has to be done. I was talking the other day to someone about the kind of... The parallel that's drawn is when Klopp arrived at Liverpool, and the kind of similar philosophical change that's required at United. The difference to me is that I think when Klopp went in at Liverpool, you'd had a manager before who played a different type of football, but it wasn't a world away from what Klopp was trying to do. So you had a few players at Liverpool who immediately got Klopp's methods. And I remember being told within a few weeks that Klopp had kind of identified Firmino and Lallana and Henderson and Milner and I think Emre Can as the players who kind of understood what he was trying to do straight away. They obviously, at least one of them, Emre Can, kind of fell by the wayside. But Emre Can had grown up in Germany. He'd played in German youth academies. It probably wasn't an alien style of football to him. Firmino played for Hoffenheim, who were a pressing team, suited Henderson and Milner's games pretty well. And Lallana was an ideal pressing midfielder. And I think the problem that Ten Hag's got is you look at that Man United team, who do you build around? Who do you make your cornerstones who are already there? And who has got the same kind of conceptual background as him on the playing staff? And there's not very many. There's maybe Jadon Sancho. There's probably Luke Shaw, because he's played under Pochettino and because he's one of the best left-backs in the world. And that's kind of it. And that makes it a much more difficult job for Ten Hag than I think has been advertised, because it's not just a case of him implementing his vision of football. You need a whole scale hierarchical change that will take years to accomplish. And the problem at United is that nobody gets years.
Yeah. I've seen, for instance, Michael Cox, who's I found interesting because he's quite an optimist in terms of where Manchester United are at. He reckons Miguel sort the midfield out, and that's basically job done. Like, you know, if United if United are able to kind of figure out a good central midfield, they'll obviously need to bring somebody in. The rest of the pieces are more or less in place. You know, I agree with him that there are a lot of players at the club who are currently looking worse or being made to look bad by how bad things are in general. But what do you think of the argument that actually, you know, sort out the central midfield and, you know, bingo, bango?
I think it's a bit, both Rangnick and Ten Hag, I'm of the understanding, have told them that they basically need about 10 players. I think actually Rangnick even said that last week, and it sounded like one of those lines you tried at a press conference, but from what I'm told, it actually wasn't. He was specifically, like, say, these are the kind of numbers he's recommended to Manchester United. And I do absolutely agree that, you know, suddenly players who seem absolutely lost causes can actually suddenly look completely different in a productive environment. And actually, if you want a perfect example of that, in fact, there's two perfect examples from a man that Manchester United possibly should have hired, Antonio Conte, and one close to home, Doherty at Tottenham Hotspur. Before him, Victor Moses at Chelsea. And like, there are examples of how any good coach, and Ten Hag is a good coach, can improve a player. And I, from that perspective, I think at the very least, because Ten Hag is, to repeat the words, a good coach, and really, you could argue actually the first up and coming coach who practices kind of, you know, the most at the cutting edge of the game, or the practice at the forefront of the game, that he's the first they've hired along those lines since Ferguson retired. And I think that at the very least should restore Manchester United to consistent Champions League qualification level, which should really be their baseline. And to be fair, what Solskjaer actually had them at for two seasons, which is, I didn't think Solskjaer was good.
I think Michael Parks is saying that all you need to do is fix the midfield, and that is probably the main problem area. Do we think that a team coached by Ten Hag, who is officially with capital letters in the right places, a good coach, like a team with Harry Maguire and like an aging and slightly disinterested Rafa Varane at centre half, and Aaron Wan-Bissaka at right back, and Rashford, who's just gone off, who's disappeared off a cliff over the last 2 years, and Sancho, who doesn't appear to have got anything like the same kind of dynamism he had in Germany. Do we think that that's a team that can challenge for the title?
No, I mean, I think that their problems are a bit, I mean, I think the fullbacks are a massive problem. You know, I mean, Luke Shaw, if you've got like a fully fit Luke Shaw, you know, he's a useful player, but he misses a lot of games, and I don't know if that's necessarily going to improve. On the other side, I think they need to get somebody else. You know what I mean? I think that's a huge shortcoming of the squad. The forwards, I don't really know what they're going to do. I mean, you know, they've got Ronaldo, who's going to be 38 next season. Cavani, you know, is leaving. Rashford has had problems, although I would expect him to improve. You know, other players who they were counting on are not going to be there. It seems as though there are a few problems there. And then with the likes of Newcastle suddenly coming. But maybe they're, you know, just to close on a positive note for them, and to bring in someone you mentioned there, Miguel, briefly, maybe Antonio Conte is not going to be around. who knows what's going to happen there. Antonio Conte, he came like a whirlwind. He won and lost in almost equal measure. I think Tottenham were Tottenham the team just behind Newcastle on that graph of this year. You know, the results have definitely improved since Conte came in, but maybe they haven't improved enough. Maybe they haven't improved enough to get them into the Champions League. This all remains to be seen. But where do you think Conte and Tottenham's tempestuous romance is at, Miguel?
I think it's 50-50 that there's, maybe actually more than 50-50, maybe kind of 60-40, that there's a break in the summer and we could well see a straight job swap between himself and Mauricio Pochettino. Because from what I've been told, basically the air around Conte, and he's hearing this from people around him, and I don't know if he thinks it himself, but I think from his press conference you can probably discern the same, that basically he thinks he's better than Tottenham Hotspur, and that there's a feeling that almost Spurs could that this could be his first job in a decade, that doesn't reflect, or over a decade, that doesn't reflect well, and that he doesn't come out with a tangible success, which is what was this sense that he wants to get out of here before he's infected with Tottenhamness. But well, the thing is, I do think that if you just isolate his impact in the team and the results, especially since from where they were in October, he has actually had a positive contribution, but he won't be seen though. And similar, actually, because this is something that's come up again over the weekend, similar the way, like, and it's been relevant to the debate about Manchester United, where it's as if kind of Pochettino's work at Spurs, because there was no silverware at the end of it, it's kind of, well, he didn't do that well. Whereas actually, if you stand back, and I tweeted about this yesterday, Tottenham got 86 points in 2016-17. That is basically a massive, massive outlier in the modern history of the Tottenham. They just don't get close to that. It was an immense achievement. And okay, what Conte has done at the moment isn't anywhere close to that. But he has had, if you just stand back and look at the results and the impact, he's had tangible improvements. But I suppose just because Tottenham are kind of a half-built squad up against wealthier rivals, there's always going to be that inconsistency, and it feeds into that frustration when the chance is there to get back into the Champions League and they might necessarily take it. But just to bring it kind of full circle in that way, yeah. I mean, I suppose like with Conte and with Manchester United, we're not actually talking about getting Manchester United back into the Champions League. What we're talking about is what Manchester United really should be. And that's even with the Glazer investment payments, really they're the only English club with a true financial muscle to challenge City. I mean, Manchester United have the weight to be up there with Manchester United, or sorry, where Manchester City and Liverpool are. They can do that, even with the Glazers owning them. Of course, there's issues because Joel Glazer demands final say and so much. That's almost a bigger problem than the financial situation they're in. But that is going to require more than any... I think that's where the debate gets bigger. That's going to require more than any single managerial appointment. And that's where it gets more complicated, and it's about what they do next.
But also there's an issue, and Ken, I know you wanted to finish on a positive for them, and neither me or Miguel are going to help with that. But okay. I think one of the issues at United is basically conceptual, and that's that there's a whole generation of United fans, probably two generations of United fans, who have grown up believing that the kind of natural order of things is that Manchester United are the most successful club in England. They are the biggest team in England. They are the kind of default champions in the same way as Bayern are in Germany and Juventus are in Italy. That if they are adequate and nobody else is amazing, then they win the league. And that was true for 20 years, because that's exactly what United were under Ferguson. They obviously had brilliant teams in that period, but there were years when United won the league just because nobody else really arose to challenge them, and they were Manchester United, so they were automatically the best. That will never happen again, whatever happens, because of the way that the finances of the game have changed, and that City are now going to be the default champions. That, you know, Guardiola will leave, and at some point City will probably stop setting ridiculous points totals, because there is a certain degree of alchemy of massively kind of financially supercharged club and the world's greatest coach that leads to 100 points, 98 points. This year may well be 95 points. But they will always be the kind of premier force. And the only way around that is probably Newcastle. And yeah, Miguel's completely right. United could get to that level. So you could find that in 5-10 years' time, it's City, Newcastle and Manchester United who are the kind of three forces of English football. But they will never stand on their own again. That period has gone. And I worry that any manager, any executive, any group of players will fall foul of that. That United could return to finishing... They could finish third 5 years in a row and be doing everything absolutely right, but still finish third. And that is a really difficult situation for them to be in, because it makes it much harder for them to gauge accurately what success looks like.
Victims of their own historic success. A somber note on which to end. Rory Smith, Miguel Delaney, thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Kung Fu kick, a fan! Manchester United fans are coming across. I have never seen as disgraceful an incident as that in all my years in football. Eric Cantona should be thrown out of the game for that sort of incident. I care not one jot about his supreme talent. He launched himself 6 feet into the crowd and kung fu kicked a supporter.
That's pretty much it for today, but Ken, slight personal digression here, if you don't mind, because I would like to send my personal congratulations to Real Betis and their veteran coach Manuel Pellegrini for their thrilling win on penalties in the Copa del Rey final on Saturday evening. For it was in Seville, Ken, the Bia, as the locals pronounce it. Look it up. That's how they pronounce it. That's where I spent a few idyllic days last week. I took a keen interest in the local culture, as I always do, of course. Yeah. And by that I mean I turned on the TV in our apartment once for 10 minutes and found myself watching Real Betis TV. Mm-hmm. Production values were poor to extremely poor, I would say. But the impression I got was that they were very excited about this Copa del Rey final. So congratulations, Coach Pellegrini. He coached a hell of a game out there on Saturday night. He coached his ass off, in fact. Coach Pellegrini coached his ass off.
You see, Coach Ancelotti is about to become the first manager to, the first coach to win the league in the top five leagues.
Mm.
England,
well, he's
Germany,
a hell of a coach.
Italy, France, and Spain. You know, Real Madrid are going to seal the deal. Poor old Barcelona. I don't know if you saw Coach Xavi is having a bit of a... Set the unwanted record of losing three consecutive home matches in one season for the first time ever. So,
Coach Xavi, I mean, you know, that's the coaching game, though. You know, Coach Ancelotti becomes the winningest coach in, you know, sort of the pan-continental realm.
Yeah.
But Coach Xavi, you know, but he's got time to turn it around.
You could argue that Rayo Vallecano's win at the Nou Camp yesterday gives the lie to the stuff that I was saying about Frank Lampard in terms of the hopelessness of a game plan which involves simply defending your own box and not really doing anything. However, they did have a bit more possession than... and it is true that Rayo Vallecano won this game with one shot on target. The one shot on target. Barcelona, 18 shots to 3, 5 shots on target to 1. And 72% possession to 28, and Rayo Vallecano were the only ones that managed to score a goal in the game. So it finished 1-0. They did have a lot more play than Everton. I mean, Everton had 93 passes, and Rayo Vallecano had 264. So, you know, they were a bit more involved in the game. I think the main difference, though, is that when you're playing against a team like Barcelona, which is, you know, a sort of a recently assembled, still a jumble of a team, you know, with some old players, some new players, some recently arrived players, a fairly new manager, players who maybe are going to be there. You know, Dembele, is he going to be there next season? Nobody knows. Is De Jong going to be there next season? It's still not really clear. So this is a team that's kind of all up in the air. And I think, you know, you can play a frustration ball against a team like that, and it might work. I mean, as it did famously against Liverpool in 2014. I just don't think that it's a realistic approach to take against a team that's doing really well. Am I repeating myself now? I'm afraid I am.
I would call it. I would call it closing the circle on today's show. Ken.
Return to where we started and know the place for the first time.
We'll have another show coming out a little later today, where my camera hogging ways at GA Games will no doubt get a mention. But for now, all that remains for me is to say thank you, Ken.
Thank you, Ciarán.
Thank you very much for listening, and we'll hopefully catch you on the World Service tomorrow.
It's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine, it's not that at all. It's the opposite of that, it's the persuasion of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news.
Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.